Time now for us to head to the hotline to speak with a gentleman that I spoke with on Friday off air. He and I had a lot of fun, a great conversation. The next thing I knew, we were 20 minutes into the conversation, and I realized I needed to get back to the show as we spoke on Friday afternoon. Eric Gray, he is the author of the book Bases to Bleachers, and this coming Saturday, he will be at the Baseball Heritage Museum. Eric, we appreciate the time very much. How are you today?
I'm fine, Andy. Thank you so much for this opportunity. It's a great treat for me.
Well, let's begin with the story of how the idea of this book sprang to life. So for those who have not heard this, what was it that brought the idea to the forefront to put this book together?
My wife and I are season ticket holders for the Giants, and at one of the games that we were at, it was in August of 2011, I was there with my wife, Lynn, my daughter, Rachel, and our friend, Cheryl, and you know, at some point in the game, as you know, baseball is a game where you can sit and just talk and think. At some point, I just turned to them and I said, so what was the greatest game in your memory that you've ever been to? What was your favorite game or favorite moment? And they gave me their answer, and I came home, sent an email with that question to about 30 people. My favorite games were, I was there the day they retired Mickey Mantle's number, and the first game I took my kids to. You know, just I made a list of six games or so. And I sent it to these people asking their favorites, and I included on this list a friend of mine who likes baseball less than anybody I've ever known. And I just did it to give him a hard time. And he came back to me with a story that was so emotional that I knew right then and there that I had to write a book. And that was the genesis for that book.
So take us through the book and what it's all about, because, you know, this is about more than just baseball. You know, with a title like Bases to Bleachers, obviously baseball is a big part of it, but it goes far beyond the scope of just baseball.
Right. As I began to collect stories, and in the 8 years of story collecting, I have 1,250 stories from 700 collaborators, I started to ask my friends by email. I asked them to ask their friends. If you were wearing an Indian shirt or a Houston Astros hat or whatever, and I saw you in a radio station, I saw you in an airport or in a restaurant or a movie theater or at spring training, wherever it was, I would ask you for a story. And I joined a Facebook group, and it just kept growing and growing and growing. And at some point, I recognized from the stories I was getting, and every time I would get one, I would start to think in my mind, you know, what can I pair this with? Where does this go? So I started chaptering. And it became very clear to me that this was less than a baseball book. It was far more a human interest book in a baseball setting. And so many of the stories have, in a way, nothing to do with the actual play of game, but they just have to do at a baseball park, watching baseball. You know, it just became, as you said, far more of an human interest book.
And what's interesting, too, are the stories that come out of this. You mentioned all the folks that you've spoken with and the environment in which you spoke with these folks as well. So in talking with you last week, I thought it was fascinating the amount of stories that you told me you originally had and how many of those you actually had to trim down to put this book together. Writing a book, I'm sure, is a lot of fun, but it's also a lot of work, and editing can be a very, very difficult part of that whole process. So give us an idea as to what that process was like, collecting all of these stories and then having to trim them down to size so you can fit as many of them as you possibly could into this book.
Yeah, it was a very, it was certainly in a way, a gut-wrenching activity to get the final process. The process of collecting them, again, in all the various ways, some people would just send me an email that the story almost needed no editing. Some people gave me what amounted to bullet points, and I would create a story from, you know, just from scarce information. Some people gave me the story over the phone. They just gave me, information. I put it all together. That part was fun. I mean, following up with people who said, oh, I've got the great story for you. Here's my email address. And, you know, not ever hearing back from them. I mean, that was a little bit hard. But the actual process of collecting the stories was actually, it was a joy. It was a joy. I started to do it when I was still working. I've been retired now for 5 years, so a lot of the time I wasn't working full-time on it. But when it came time to finally, you know, when I found a publisher and it came time to put it together, I had all these stories. I chaptered any story that I thought had a reasonable shot to be in a book that was, you know, that was good enough to be kind of book worthy, as some people said. I put them in a huge draft, all in different chapters, and the draft was twice as long as it was supposed to be. And at that point, I just had to cut and cut, knowing that there'll be a second volume, leaving some great stories for the second volume, leaving some whole chapters for the second volume. I mean, you know, the story that you would think would lead off this book would be My First Game. Well, that's going to be in book two. And I can't really tell you why. It just worked out that way.
Well, we want people to go out and buy book two, right? That's all part of the process here.
So. Right, right. My wife made it very clear that anybody whose story is going to be in the second book should not feel bad that it's not in the first. This is not a question of the story wasn't good enough. It was just a question of, you know, balancing. You know, I wanted stories from, you know, from men and from women, from major leagues and little leagues, from, you know, people all over the country and, quite honestly, people around the world. I just needed to make sure that I've got two, that I'm going to have two volumes that are, you know, that are comparable in quality.
Is it difficult holding any of those back that you want to make sure to keep that balance? I'd have to imagine there's one or two you think, oh, I got to get this out right away, or no?
Yeah, it was very difficult in terms of the stories being incredible, and honestly, it was more difficult for me emotionally because there were some people who I'm very close with, and for whatever reason, their story is going to go in book two. Now, in the cases where I know that I left that chapter for book two, for example, there's a chapter, it's called, tentatively called, you know, Mickey, Willie, and the Boys of the, and the, you know, and the Greatest Generation, the Golden Era of Baseball. Stories about that were left for book two, and a really close friend of mine, I had to leave the story out of book one because that's going to go in chapter two. So yes, it was very emotional for me to make this process and then to have to tell people, and you know, I think most people have understood and accepted it.
Eric Gray, author of the book Bases to Bleachers, is joining us here on Bullseye on the Afternoon this Saturday. He'll be at the Baseball Heritage Museum. And, Eric, we've come to that point in the interview where we get to tell some stories. Now, you were nice enough to share some of these with me earlier today. There are some really terrific ones here. I want to start with the two Cleveland-related stories. Let's start with the one here that involves the great Bambino himself.
You got it. So my wife and I were visiting our aunt in an assisted living place in Florida, and we sat down at a meal, and a guy sits down at the table, an older gentleman. He sits down, and he started to talk about baseball. I didn't bring it up. And he starts giving me a couple of stories. I mentioned he was at the game when Gil McDougall hit the ball off Herb Score's head. And he gave me this other story. And what's interesting, I wrote it up, and I tried to send it back to him, and our aunt never saw Howard again. And I'm, you know, don't know if he moved, don't know if something happened to him, but I'm so glad that I wrote it down and was able to remember enough to make a story out of it. And this is it. When I was a boy, about 9 or 10, living in Cleveland, my dad would always take me to see the Yankees when they came to town. In those days, there wasn't much security around the ballpark or even guarding the players. So one day in 1932, we were able to just walk into the Yankee clubhouse. My dad recognized Babe Ruth, and amazingly, we were able to walk right over and shake his hand. 80 years later, I still remember it clearly. How can you ever forget a day like that? And that's from a gentleman named Howard.
Wow. And I think I would agree with that. How in the world could you forget that? And, Eric, I think that story is a perfect example of just how fun that had to be for you to put this book together. Not just the story that comes out of that, because that's an incredible story. How many people can say they just walked up and shook the hand of Babe Ruth? But the way that you get these stories, too, I think that's got to be a lot of fun for you to put these together.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, the book, in terms of the structure of the book, changed, and I'll go into that when I read one of the next stories. But it just became, you know, an interesting process for me to kind of think about how this book was going to all fit together. And, you know, that story alone made me realize that what I would really like more than anything else, and I have some, but what I really would like more than anything else is going to be something that's going to be hard to do, which is to get as many stories as I can from the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. And, you know, obviously there aren't that many people around now who were alive then. But one thing that happened is a friend of mine said, and it's kind of right of that era, a friend of mine said, you know, my dad was a vendor at Yankee Stadium, and his favorite ball player was Lou Gehrig, and he was there the day that Lou Gehrig made his famous speech. And, you know, kind of like my eyes opened, you know, I know, like I just had pizza for the first time. And I realized that what we were able to do is we could write a story credited, and everybody in this book gets their name credited, and I don't take credit for any of this. You know, that story is going to be credited to Ben Fiennes as told to his daughter, Roz Idelson. And that will be in a chapter for the second book called Stories Handed Down. So I'm always trying to find people who can tell me their father or their grandfather told them a great story.
Baseball is an amazing game because of all the connections. The web of baseball is always discussed amongst players and coaches and executives because somebody knows somebody through something else. But it's amazing how you can also kind of apply that to fans as well.
Absolutely.
And another one about Cleveland. This is a story I thought that was pretty intriguing because it gives us a little bit of a peek behind the curtain, so to speak, about how the mind of a scout or a general manager works. And in this case, it's a story about former Indians GM Phil Seguin.
Right. The person who wrote me the story, and I'll identify when done, when I'm finished, I believe that she is listening to this program right now. And this is from a chapter called Women in Baseball. One thing I learned is that women, particularly players, make a big distinction between playing hardball and playing softball. I mean, you know, the game may be the same to people just in general, but it's really important to them. And this chapter is about women who were involved in baseball at some professional level. So here's the story. Cleveland was putting on a citywide high school baseball all-star game. I was working in the Indians front office at the time, and Phil Seguin, the general manager of the Tribe, came into my office and asked me if I knew where Edgewater Park was, the location of the all-star game. Of course I did, because I was from Cleveland. He said that if I drove, we could cut out of work and go see this game. So here I was, driving a 1969 Volkswagen Beetle with the general manager of the Cleveland Indians sitting next to me. When we got there were many Major League scouts present. They were all congregating behind the home plate screen. The game started, and Phil came up to me and said, "Let's see how good of a scout you are. Give me a scouting report on the pitcher." I knew the pitcher from a high school in town was being touted as a very high draft pick. I watched the kid pitching, and I thought to myself, he's not that good. Do I tell the truth, or do I say what I think is expected of me? I told the truth. Phil started laughing hysterically, and said, "It's a good thing you said that, because the kid I'm watching is pitching for the other side." So when the side changed and the kid Phil came to see came into pitch, Phil watched for two or three batters from behind home plate and also from first base. He came to get me, saying, "Okay, I've seen enough, let's go." I looked at him kind of quizzically, and he said, "The kid's going to be a first-round draft choice." He was. Future major leaguer and 15-game winner, Ken Kravick. And that's from my friend Peg Wagner.
Incredible, isn't it? I mean, that's such a great story because it kind of gives you a peek behind the curtain as to how that works. But it also tells you that even in the day before we had all this video and all the analytics that they put in play now, even back then, there are certain guys that just had an eye for talent.
Yep. And, you know, I think a lot of people think that, you know, that the statistics and the analytics are important, but there's also the eye test, right?
Absolutely. And there's still something to be said for the eye test. It still serves a big, big purpose.
That's right. That's right.
You also, Eric, have a couple of non-Cleveland stories that you want to share as well. I thought they were both hilarious in way, way, way different ways here, but one involves Mr. Cub.
That's correct. So the person who told this story is a friend of mine. I worked for, my career was with Job Corps, which is a job training program for disadvantaged youth, and I led some national work groups, and Sarah was on my work group, and I kind of became a mentor and friend to her. We lost touch, and then when we were visiting my wife's family in Minneapolis, we got back in touch with Sarah, went to lunch, and when I told her about the book, she said, "You know, Eric, I'm not really a baseball fan. You know, but send me your book description. I have a lot of friends who are. You'll get some great stories." Well, I never got any stories from any of her friends, but I got this from Sarah the next day. And this story is so important to the book, not only because it's great, but because when I got the story, it made me totally rethink the structure of the book. So let me just read it to you now. I am not a fan of any sports. I've been to a few baseball games, but only when I'd get free tickets and go for the experience of drinking beer, eating stadium food, and just having a good time with friends. It's not that I don't like baseball. I just don't know much about the game, who the players are, or many of the rules of the game. I was in Chicago for a Job Corps conference and meeting my friend Pearl in the bar of the hotel where I was staying. When I got to the bar, there were just a few people there, but not Pearl. An older gentleman was sitting alone at the bar, and I felt it would be safe sitting next to him, as I preferred not to sit alone. I asked if I could join him while waiting for my friend. We had a few drinks and chatted about life, my job, the fact that I liked working with young adults, and then I was excited to see my friend who I hadn't seen for quite a while. He shared little about himself. I was just glad that I felt comfortable with him and that we could sit there together. When Pearl arrived, I turned to the man and said, it was nice to meet him, although we didn't know each other's name. I introduced myself, and he said, nice to meet you, Sarah. My name is Ernie Banks. We shook hands, and I went to sit with my friend. My friend, a native Chicagoan, asked me who I was sitting with, and when I told her, she started to shake a little and asked me if I knew who Ernie Banks was. Well, yes, it's the man over there at the bar, I answered. That's Mr. Banks, Mr. Cub. You must go ask him for his autograph. He's the most famous Cub player ever, she replied excitedly. So I wandered back over and said, Mr. Banks, my friend over there tells me I need to get your autograph. You're Mr. Cub? You must have been one great basketball player. Well, that sure made him laugh, and he said it was great to be in Chicago having a casual conversation with someone who had no idea who he was. And, by the way, he played baseball with the Cubs, not basketball. He gave me an autograph and wished me luck. Oh, the questions I could have asked, the things we could have talked about, but it wasn't a missed opportunity. We had a good conversation, a few laughs and fun moments as two strangers keeping each other company on a slow afternoon in the bar. How many people can say that? Everyone to whom I tell that story laughs as soon as I mention Ernie's name, and they can't believe I had no idea that the Chicago Cubs were a baseball team. I still have that autograph somewhere. He even wrote, good luck with Job Corps. That's from my friend Sarah West in St. Paul. And that story is so important because when I got that story, I mean, I was like in awe. The first thing I thought is, oh, my God, this story is unbelievable. The second thing I thought was, there's no place for it in my book. And the third thing I thought was, I'm going to make a place for it in my book. And that made me realize that I now had to think about structuring my book to fit the content rather than having content fit some preordained structure.
That's fantastic. I love that story. When you sent that to me earlier, I couldn't stop laughing when I read that, and she thought he was a basketball player. That is terrific.
Yep. And you know what, Andy? Everybody that when I do my readings, everybody that I read that story to, they laugh as well.
you can't help but laugh at that. And you can't help but laugh at this next one, even though this story goes in a much, much different direction, because this next non-Cleveland story you're about to tell involves a family brawl of all things in the Bronx.
That's right. My wife and I were coming on a vacation from Cabo San Lucas, and we were taking a shuttle bus to the airport. And we started to talk to some people. And, of course, what was I talking about but my book? Of course, I didn't remember that we had actually met these people on the shuttle bus to the resort, but that didn't really matter because Marie sent me this story. July of 2002, our family went to Yankee Stadium to take in the sights and watch a baseball game. It was a hot afternoon, and the stadium was packed. Our seats were in the third deck on the first base side, and in the section to our right was a family of about 50 people, ranging in ages from newborn kids to elderly grandparents. I know they were a family because they spoke pre-incident with one of the characters. During the game, one of the family members kept dipping his fingers into his beer and dripping it down the pants of one of his relatives sitting in front of him. At one point, I said to my daughter, Lisa, who is 12 and very innocent and naive, and my sister-in-law, Kathy, I told them that this was not going to end well if the beer dripping kept up. Sure enough, around the sixth inning, the drippy had enough. He stood up, visual, lots of tattoos, shorts down below his butt, and multiple piercings. He turned around, and he landed a right hook onto his relative's jaw. At that point, the majority of the family of 50 or so started fighting, kids included, pushing and shoving each other down the rows, piling up at the cement wall at the first row. My first thought was, wow, the holidays must really be something at their house. My second thought was, these people are going to fall over the edge and end up on the 200 level. At this point, Tattoo Man lost his shorts. They completely came off, along with his boxers, right in front of 12-year-old Lisa. She saw everything, and I do mean everything. Next, the police, as well as numerous security people, arrived and pushed me, Lisa, and Kathy out of our seats and into my husband, Larry. Larry, my brother Mark, and my two sons, Brian and Carl, had no clue what was going on. Larry told me to sit down and watch the baseball game. I told him I couldn't sit because the police had taken over our seats. He was totally clueless to the brawl taking place because he was watching the game. Ultimately, the whole section was ejected from the stadium for fighting. Some were even arrested and taken away in handcuffs. This is a baseball memory that engraved in our family's memory bank forever, especially Lisa's. I think the Yankees won the game that day. We regularly attend Seattle Mariners games and have never witnessed anything close to this. Yankee baseball at its finest. Must be an East Coast thing. And that's from Marie Tetley.
Wow.
And wow. One really great thing is that I have become friends with some of these people. I mean, I don't mean just someone that I exchange an email with periodically, but I know when we get to Seattle, we'll be having dinner with Marie and Larry. And that has been one of the totally unexpected joys of this book. You were asking me before about, you know, how I felt about the whole process. Well, making friends all over the place has just been, it's been a joy.
I can only imagine. I mean, boy, those are just terrific stories, just fantastic stuff. Eric, I know this Saturday you're going to be at the Baseball Heritage Museum, and before we let you go, what can you tell us about this Saturday's presentation?
Well, what I'm going to do is kind of explain some of the things that I talked about with you at the beginning of this conversation, and I'm going to be reading more stories, of course, than that. There's a chance I'll be reading these stories, but I'll probably be reading for about 30 minutes or so. And I hope people can come down. I mean, I think what's happening is that, you know, we've done a bunch of readings here, and it's pretty much been friends of ours, and they're all coming to support me, and they know the book is going to be nice, but they don't really realize how good it is until they get there. And I want to be clear about something, please, Andy. When I brag about this book, I'm not bragging about myself. I'm bragging about how lucky I am to have been the recipient of all these great stories. I may have done a lot of work on it, but if I didn't have the stories, I wouldn't have the book. And, you know, I will be there doing readings. I will obviously have copies to sign. If people want to buy the book, it's called, as you said, Bases to Bleachers, a collection of personal baseball stories from the stands and beyond. It's available on Barnes & Noble. It's available on Amazon. And I also have copies here at home that if they're interested, they can contact me, and I can send out a signed copy. And I guess I should probably give you my email address, which is, might be complicated, but it's long but actually simple. It's eric.baseballstories@gmail.com.
That's simple enough. That's simple enough. Eric, this was a blast. Thank you so much for coming on today's show. We hope that everybody can make it out this Saturday at the Baseball Heritage Museum. And you can also check out the book as well on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, several places you can get to it. It's Bases to Bleachers. Eric, thank you again for stopping by. We had a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you so much. There is also a Facebook page, Bases to Bleachers, so people can check it out there. And Andy, I want to thank you for giving me this great opportunity. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric. Again, that's author Eric Gray joining us here on Bullseye on the Afternoon. If you're in the area, make sure you stop by the Baseball Heritage Museum this Saturday. Eric will be there giving a presentation. He'll be signing some books as well. And, boy, those are just a few of the stories that you can find in that book. Some really, really cool stuff in there.